Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at the film 2001, A Space Odyssey, and how the movie 50 years ago set a new standard for the use of music, sound, and silence. First, the United States could re-enter the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, a year after President Trump pulled the country out of the multi-nation trade agreement. The president attacked the agreement even before he announced his presidential campaign. But with a growing trade dispute with China and the immediate effects of tariffs on some U.S. industries, President Trump is reconsidering his decision to pull out. He asked his economic advisors to look into what it would take to negotiate the country back into the TPP. Mark Koplovich is an associate professor of political science and public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Give us a brief rundown, this might be hard to do, of what the Trans-Pacific Partnership did when the U.S. was involved, what it's doing without us now.
Yeah. So the TPP was signed in February 2016, and it was an agreement of 12 Pacific Rim countries, a trade agreement, but it also governed things like investment and patent protection and intellectual property. And it was including about 40% of the world economy, the U.S., Mexico, Canada, Korea, Japan, et cetera, not China.
Not China
notably,
seems like a key part of this.
Notably. And, you know, as I think we spoke about previously, there were both economic and kind of geopolitical reasons for this. So economically, a big thing was accessing the Japanese market and the broader Pacific Rim. But geopolitically, the Obama administration sort of viewed TPP along with a lot of the military cooperation agreements that they had signed with Japan and Korea and India over the years as a way of kind of ring-fencing China in the Pacific. So, you know, there were both economic consequences, I think, and political consequences when President Trump came into office. One of the first things he did, I think it was the third day of his administration, says that the U.S. is withdrawing from TPP. It, you know, sort of sent a shockwave through the region.
And Donald Trump's opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership went back before he announced as a candidate for president, continued through the campaign. He talked about how this agreement was raping the United States. What kind of things now we're seeing him say, hey, guys, figure out how we can get back into this thing, maybe on different terms. What is turning this around now?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of hard to give a clear answer to that because I think one of the things we're seeing with this announcement is there's not a real clear strategy in the Trump administration that putting what we've seen with Chinese tariffs, what we've seen with threatening to withdraw from NAFTA and those negotiations and these moves on TPP, it's hard to sort of put all those things together and say the Trump administration is trying to accomplish something clear with their trade policy. I think there's a recognition that there are a lot of firms and industries and consumers that probably would have actually gotten a lot of good things out of the TPP and trade agreements more broadly. I think specifically on this, one of the things that China has announced, as the U.S. is announcing tariffs or proposed tariffs in the last few weeks, China announced that they might put on tariffs of soybeans. And China's our largest export market for soybeans. So there's been a lot of lobbying now from the agricultural sector, especially here in the Midwest, that that's a really bad thing. The trade agreements might be something that we actually benefit from. So I think in the short term, that's what's going on. But in the longer term, it's hard to put all these things together.
I think the core here is trade is tricky. We see now the head of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, saying, hey, whoa, no, the good call coming out. Let's not go back in.
Yep.
So for a lot of factory workers, especially in the Midwest, seeing TPP as a bad thing for them. Agriculture, farmers here in Wisconsin, farm state senators saying, whoa, this is a great export opportunity for us. Get back into this thing. It's probably going to help some people and hurt some people.
Yeah, and it depends. It's always the answer with trade is, you know, is it good for the United States? Well, which part, which sector, which industry, which geographic region? You know, you see Elizabeth Warren, Sherrod Brown, a lot of Democrats are opposed to TPP for the very traditional kind of pro-labor manufacturing industries that have, you know, been distributional losers from trade over the last 30 or 40 years. But it's complicated because you have agricultural exports and a lot of multinational corporations now are both importers and exporters, right? And so one of the big things with is TPP good or bad or are these tariffs with China good or bad is firms are exporting to China and other countries, but they're also importing intermediate inputs into production. And so when you put up tariffs, what you're actually doing is raising the cost of production for firms. They might benefit to some extent from, you know, decreased foreign competition because of the tariffs, but their overall cost of business is increasing. So it really depends on what sector we're talking about.
So my assembly plant might be getting components from China, but still manufacturing, I'm putting in quotes, we're putting that stuff together here. So it's a Chinese product. It's an American product too.
Yeah, we're talking about, you know, steel tariffs and aluminum tariffs. And then is it good or bad for an auto company or an auto factory? And now the inputs of production just went up by 25%. Also, a lot of trade. Trump is obsessed with bilateral trade deficits, right? And it's sort of a strange way to think about trade in this era of the globalization of production, because a lot of things that come from China and are coded as exports from China are actually things that were assembled in China and are part of that globalization of production. So it is hard to say, is this a Chinese product or an American product? Is it good for China? Is it bad for China? The world's not as black and white anymore.
Talking to Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, President Trump says, hey, maybe we should get back into this thing, renegotiate our ways back into the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. If we want it, do they still want us, Mark?
Yeah. So this is the, you know, again, as I'm a political scientist, I study economic issues, but this is the really interesting issues, I think, for me, are these political issues, both internationally and also domestically. So internationally, what happened after the U.S. backed away from TPP is the remaining 11 countries, right, driven largely by Canada, pushed forward, and they've now signed an agreement. It's now called the CPTPP. And one of the things they did was suspended about 20 of the clauses that were in the original TPP agreement, which were there because the U.S. wanted them. And these were things
stuff that we negotiated for.
Stuff were things we negotiated for. Really, what we wanted about this agreement wasn't as much about trade, but it was about intellectual property protection. There was going to be an investor state dispute court where multinational corporations, if they got into some sort of legal dispute in Korea or in Japan, there'd be an international court to arbitrate that. Patent protection for American pharmaceutical companies. So those things were suspended and taken out in the agreement that was signed. They've also been left open with the possibility that maybe if the U.S. comes back, that they could be put back in. But the problem now is we are going back in, even if we do this. It's announced it hasn't happened, but let's say it would happen. There's sort of two problems. So one is the agreement now has been signed and is being pushed through ratification procedures domestically. So these other 11 countries negotiated a trade agreement over a very long period of time, finally balancing everything so they could all go home and ratify it. And now the U.S. might want to come back in and go back to the previous agreement with those extra clauses. Now you might not be able to ratify it in a Japan or in a Canada. So one of the Japanese chief diplomats today in the Financial Times said the agreement is like glasswork, right? And so we're going to break the glass, perhaps, if the bull comes back into the China shop. And then the domestic problem in the United States is TPP, for a lot of the reasons we've already spoken about, isn't necessarily popular. It's not clear there's a coalition in Congress, right? Even a bipartisan coalition, that if the U.S. came back and said, now we want to ratify this, that you could get it through Congress.
Briefly, as we wrap up, we were in it, we're out of it, now we're looking, maybe getting back in. Are these other countries going to be saying, hey, no, you guys are a chaos machine, we've got this delicate thing, forget about it?
Yeah. This is the other aspect. You know, when you think about the credibility of the United States at this point, there's been back and forth. We're going to have tariffs. We're not going to have tariffs. We're going to have exceptions to tariffs. We're going to sign the TPP. This is the worst agreement ever. We're going to walk away from it. Now we want back in. So when you're thinking about international negotiations, one of the things you're thinking about is the credibility of the partner that you're bargaining with. And it's not clear. And I think most countries in this 11 are sitting around saying Trump could change his mind again 2 or 3 weeks from now. We need to hold off. And even if he says he's going to sign it, we're not really sure that we can take him at his word. So we've lost a lot of bargaining leverage in shaping the agreement, but also in being able to make credible commitments to our trade partners.
Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Mark Koplovich is an associate professor of political science at public affairs at the UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the president's suggestion that the U.S. could rejoin the Trans-Pacific Partnership after leaving that trade agreement last year. Last week, we marked the 50-year anniversary of 2001: A Space Odyssey with a look at how the film was made. Today, we're going to dive into the unique music and sound choices that were made by director Stanley Kubrick. We recently talked to Michael Galope, an assistant professor in the Department of Cultural Studies and Comparative Literature at the University of Minnesota. He's the author of Deep Refrains, Music, Philosophy, and the Ineffable. We asked him why the music and sound Kubrick used is so important in understanding this unique film. Well, the music and sound of 2001, maybe more so than for other movies, is really important. Can you talk about why there's such a key part of 2001?
Well, I think 2001 is unusual as a film because so much of the story and a lot of its deep philosophical questions are actually told to us with the music and not with the words. The characters that Kubrick puts in the film, people have remarked they're more or less static or emotionless, and the dialogue they have feels relatively ordinary, sometimes perfunctory and uninteresting.
Hi.
Good morning, sir.
Morning.
We haven't seen you up here for a long time.
No. Very nice to see you again.
Did you have a pleasant flight, sir?
Yes, very nice, thanks. I think Mr. Miller of Station Security is supposed to be meeting me.
Oh, well, may I call him for you?
Would you please?
And the drama that there is, principally with Hal in the second half of the film, is very cold and slow. So the film is dominated by these elegant, slow-moving shots. And they're accompanied by music and sometimes other kinds of sound or even silence. But Kubrick gives us a lot of time to think without hearing any words. But exactly what we're supposed to think during all this time remains unclear.
And I understand, I just learned this recently, Kubrick had originally commissioned a score, an original score for the film, then changed his mind at almost literally the last minute about what music to use.
Yeah, that's right. So Kubrick commissioned a score from an established composer, Alex North, that had done the music for Kubrick's Spartacus. Kubrick had in place a selection of classical music recordings that were there sort of as temporary tracks, and he could use just for the purposes of editing, which was a relatively common practice. Kubrick then showed Alex North the edit of the film with this classical music in place, but he ultimately decided to reject this relatively traditional film score that North delivered and decided to stick with the classical music that he was using just as a temporary track.
Now let's talk about some of the ways that Kubrick ultimately did use music and sound design and talk with the famous opening sequence that I think people probably think of when they think of music from 2001.
Right. So this is the iconic opening credit of 2001. We hear the sunrise fanfare from Richard Strauss's tone poem Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which is an orchestra piece based on Friedrich Nietzsche's book of the same name, which had actually just been published a few years earlier in 1891. And so on screen, what do we see? We see the earth slowly rising, and we watch the sun rise symmetrically over the moon. To make of the opening. One place to look that many have looked at is the book that Strauss based this orchestra piece on, Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. And this is a book that discusses grand metaphysical themes about human evolution, about human destiny. And Nietzsche's book also contains the famous declaration that God is dead. So we're talking about the destiny of humanity, but in the context of this cold, physical, real universe. So in the opening, we just hear the music. We hear this fanfare, and we haven't read all this philosophy. Even with just the sound and the image, we know something is up. The next time we see this image of a symmetrical aligning of the planets at the beginning of the Stargate sequence, where Jupiter is aligned with its moons, and this mysterious monolith appears horizontally, and then we hear it once more, or we hear the music again at the end, the Zarathustra fanfare returns. Dave, our astronaut on the Odyssey, is mysteriously transformed into this star child. So the film is framed by this fanfare, and it's sort of a grand framing that tells us something vague. This film is philosophical. There's some big philosophical question about man's place in the cosmos that we're being asked. But Kubrick doesn't tell us what to think. He doesn't spell out all the particulars. He lets the audience decide what it all means. And this is one of those examples where, rather than having, say, a voiceover describing what you should think philosophically about the destiny of man, just using the fanfare keeps it open-ended for the audience.
And talk about how Kubrick uses music to represent the aliens in the film.
So this is a very famous choice of Kubrick's. He chose four pieces by the Hungarian avant-garde composer Georg Ligeti. And this music frequently, I think, always appears with the monoliths. And it's not easy to say what this music is doing, other than to say it indicates probably some kind of terrifying alien presence. The monoliths are always, I think, accompanied by Ligeti. We know that they're linked somehow. So in this sequence where they're going to discover the monolith on the moon, the astronauts arrive there, and they've uncovered this monolith, and we hear this piece by Ligeti, his Requiem, at the excavation site. And we know nothing about these aliens. We don't know what they look like. We don't really know what they're trying to communicate. They're not represented in the film. So Kubrick could have made them look like insects or funny creatures with strange proportions, but actually, by using music, the aliens are totally intangible. And it's an amazing example of using the mysterious, ineffable qualities of music that kind of keep you perplexed. Anytime Ligeti's music comes into the movie, you know the aliens are there in some mysterious form, but you just don't know exactly what they look like or what they're saying. You're less clueless about what they are. All you get is this numinous, scary feeling, and it's on the screen coupled with this totally blank, cool black rectangle, the monolith. And so when you watch these YouTube films online, people speculate endlessly. What is this thing? I mean, what a brilliant directorial decision to make the aliens kind of unrepresentable and to just put it on this box that is a sort of endless puzzle, and it doesn't have a specific meaning, and this sort of drives people crazy.
That's music. Earlier you mentioned the use of silence. Can you talk about silence and sparse sound effects in, you know, the isolating world of space?
Aside from the use of this classical music, the rest of the movie is really dominated by a very dry sound. Almost, I call it like a hospital-like drama. These two astronauts, they're stoic astronauts, they're intelligent, they're highly trained, and they're in a power struggle with this unstable, paranoid, control freak, hungry, a control freak computer named Hal. And so in much of this part of the film, there are three sounds. You have the hiss of Dave's oxygen supply, Hal's apparently fearful emotional appeals to Dave to stop the disconnection process, and the rhythm of Dave's breathing.
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave? I know everything hasn't been quite right with me, but I can give you my complete assurance that my work will be back to normal. Will you stop, Dave? I'm afraid, Dave.
And hearing the sound for minutes on end puts us inside the space helmet. It puts us inside where Dave is, and it kind of grips us, but in a way that's almost meditative, because it's This is not, Kubrick is not making a Disneyland version of space with laser guns and space creatures and fairy tales. By using this silence, Kubrick is creating a very realistic vision of space, empty, boring, and actually quite lethal. And something about that emptiness, like with the Ligeti and as with the opening fanfare, invites a lot of thinking. It gives us time to think. So I think it's an example of Kubrick using the sound and music to keep us thinking about the destiny of man, about these paradoxes, but without telling us exactly what to think.
And Michael, a lot of people, when they saw this movie in 1968, probably if they watch in 2018, come out of the movie asking, what just happened there? From what you've been saying, it sounds like focusing, thinking about the music and the sound is going to help us come up with an answer to that question.
Well, it's paradoxical. I think the poetry of the film, the reason we keep discussing it, is that he left it open-ended, and he did such an excellent job of leaving it open-ended. I think that, in some ways, captures what makes this film so philosophical, is that it doesn't have a specific thing to say about technology. It seems like artificial intelligence is a dangerous thing because of the way HAL behaves. Yet, it's unclear exactly where we end up. Is the Star Child an overcoming of technology? Is it a transformation into a whole other form? It's so open-ended, it allows us to think about these grand questions, but in a way without any specific answer.
We can come up with an answer, not necessarily the answer.
Right.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Michael.
Thank you.
It's puzzling. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this before.
That was Michael Gallope, an assistant professor in the Department of Cultural Studies and Comparative Literature at the University of Minnesota. He took us through how music and sound were used in the film, made 50 years ago today, 2001 A Space Odyssey. First, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Chef Eddie Hernandez grew up in Monterrey, Mexico, one of the largest cities in that country. He ate his mom's home-cooked food every day and was inspired to learn how to cook by his grandmother. As a teenager, Eddie moved to the southern United States with his rock band. The music career didn't pan out. Instead, he got into cooking, mixing southern food with Mexican traditions. Eddie Hernandez is the executive chef and business partner of Taqueria del Sol, a James Beard Award nominee chain with locations in Tennessee and Georgia. His new cookbook is called Turnip Greens and Tortillas, A Mexican Chef Spices Up the Southern Kitchen. Eddie, thanks a lot for joining us today. Eddie, are you there?
Give me 1 second, please.
Okay, we'll get to Eddie in just a moment. Some background there, getting his phone. We'll have our producer pick him up and make sure we've got him locked in on the line. And in the meantime, Eddie has a lot of tips and ideas combining the two traditions, Mexican food and Southern food, and new twists on both of those as well. And if these are types of foods that you love to eat or cook, you can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we've got a few recipes from Eddie at WPR.org/Food Friday. That's WPR.org/Food Friday. Eddie, do we have you now?
Yes.
Great. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Start us off with a little background. What did you, Eddie, grow up eating?
You know what? It's the volume is a little low. I can barely hear you a little bit. So can you ask me again?
Okay, we're going to try reconnecting maybe on a different phone line. Sounds like he's having trouble hearing us. So again, WPR.org/Food Friday or find recipes at the Ideas Network Facebook page. And while you're there, let us know if you are a fan of the foods of the Deep South and or Mexico and if you could see how they might be put together. And you can join in, too, with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. We've got a few recipes that, pending guest, we'll get into. Slow cooker barbacoa tacos party platter, corn, poblano, and cheese tamales, and a dessert, natilla. That one's new to me. So that's to look forward to as we try to get our guest online for Food Friday. Reminder, coming up after in the next hour, we'll round up some of the top stories in Wisconsin news from over the course of the last week with Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin. That's coming up in just a bit. And then later in the show, we'll look at the impacts of lead contamination and the sources of lead contamination in waterways. Do we have Eddie? Yeah, let's try him again. Eddie, are you hearing me better now?
Yes.
Wonderful. So tell us, start us off with what happened. You came to the southern United States and you saw some things in common between southern food and Mexican food. What do they have in common?
Actually, we have a lot of things in common. For one thing, you know, we both use a lot of corn in hominy, but we also like to eat a lot of pork, you know, not just on the barbecue format, but also in chicharrones and cracklings. And quelites is almost exactly the same plant as the turnip green. And I grew up eating quelites in Mexico, you know, not on a daily basis, but quite often. So I really was able to understand what the food in the South was and decided just to start not modernizing, per se, but to give the people a choice. Mm. You know, now you can have, you know, cornbread done in a different way. You can have turnip greens done in another way and barbecue done differently and grits that are different. So the idea was to provide the guests with an option. You know what fried chicken is, but how about fried chicken on a taco? You know, and everybody loves smoked meat, so I came up with a smoked pork taco. And then it just grew from there, and it went on and on, and I finally got really good at it. And I think people really enjoy what we do.
And sometimes when people think about Southern food or Mexican food, they'll think, oh, is this authentic? And one thing you don't care about, Eddie, is if it's authentic or not, right?
I totally don't. I never have. Even when I was a teenager, I always cook things that, for one thing, that I like and that I will eat. And then, you know, I'm just the type of person that likes to share. So I will give some of my food to some of my friends and everybody else, and everybody agreed that, you know, I had a pretty good knack for cooking, and eventually I became who I am today. But I think a lot of people emphasize really heavy on doing food one way because they've been told to do it that way. I like variety. I don't try to be better than everybody else. I just try to make food that is good and it gives you an option.
And a couple pieces of advice that I thought were really interesting. One, I use if I'm trying to do Mexican-style food or Tex-Mex-style or Southwestern or whatever, I'll often use lime. You say lime's fine, but in a lot of cases, we might want to try lemon instead. Why is that?
Especially if you're doing a salad or guacamole. Lime, the acidity in the lime is a lot higher than it is on a lemon. So when you squeeze lemon into lettuce, like you're doing a lemon dressing, you know, just a basic oil and lemon, the greens will stay firm. They don't get wilted as fast. When you add lime to it, it cooks the greens and it makes them wilt a lot faster, they get soggy. Same thing when you do guacamole. Almost everybody in the South or in the United States likes to put lime on the guacamole. I think it's too bitter for the guacamole, and it takes away the flavor of the avocados. Well, by using lime, I still retain the color of the avocado, but I also preserve the flavor. And what I like to do is, when I say, you know, this is a chipotle sauce, you know, just to say, I want this stuff to taste like chipotle. I don't want this thing to taste like cinnamon or cumin or whatever else. I like to cook with a specific reference point. If it's going to be a cinnamon thing, then you're going to taste the cinnamon. If it is a avocado, I want you to taste the avocado. And if I do a salad, I want a light dressing that will allow you to taste the lettuce. Because when you put limes, the limes take away all that. And that's why I don't like it. You know, but it's a tell everybody. That's my idea of doing things. If you don't like it, well, then make it the way you like it. You know, I'm not going to show up with the police patrol and raid your house because you put in lime.
And another tip I love is you use a lot of hot peppers. You're kind of spicing up the Southern food. You like to roast those peppers a little bit first. Why and how do you do that?
Okay, there's different reasons why. Then again, we go back into what you're doing. We have a salsa in the book. It's called Asada. And the jalapenos are charred along with the tomatoes until they're like completely black, almost like into ashes. And when you do the salsa, then you get a smokiness back from the skin of the pepper and the tomatoes. But sometimes, like if I'm going to use jalapenos on my guacamole, I fry them in a little oil in a pan. Just warm them up. You don't have to really fry them, but just warm them up. And that takes the green flavor of the jalapeno away, and it preserves the heat and the flavor. Now it doesn't taste like it's green, and it doesn't compete with the flavor of the avocado. So and for some other things, I will boil them, you know, I will bake them, I will roast them. You can do so many things with one jalapeno, and it affects the flavor of the end product dramatically. And, you know, I want people to know that we've been told to do this and to do that. No, I'm going to tell you that you can do this and that because you want to do it, not because I say that you need to do it.
I want to check.
I said before, I'm not food correct. I cook to make good food, and so I don't follow, you know, all these trends and stuff like that, which I don't agree with.
I want to check out one of the recipes you shared with us. We have this up at WPR.org/FoodFriday. You kind of recreate a Mexican-style barbecue in a slow cooker. The recipe is slow cooker barbacoa. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Tacos party platter. Tell us about this.
Well, what about this kind of thing? You know, my uncle in Mexico used to do this thing. And I got to where I was able to understand how the crock pot worked. And we're talking 35 years ago. And I was able to understand that I can cook stuff in it overnight. So I will get, you know, like beef cheeks and maybe some brisket, put a little bit of bay leaves and some salt and black pepper, put it on a crock pot, turn it at 250, turn it on at 10 o'clock in the evening, and then at 10 o'clock in the morning, all I need is some tortillas and some salsa, and I'm ready to go. You know?
And your house smells great.
Yeah, and you don't get to be over there putting coils and wood into the smoke. So it's a way to really speed up the process and to minimize the work. I'm really good about making sure that you can cook food, you know, efficiently, economically, tasty, but most of all, fast. Because when we're hungry, we want to eat right now. We don't want to wait 6 hours for the results to reduce.
We're talking to Eddie Hernandez on this edition of Food Friday. His new cookbook is called Turnip, Greens, and Tortillas, A Mexican Chef Spices Up the Southern Kitchen. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about Mexican cooking, about Southern cooking, or about trying to combine the two? Are you having trouble getting the perfect salsa or guacamole? Do you have recipes with roots in the South or Mexico as well? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Coming up, some tamales. This is Central Time. Right now, we're talking with Chef Eddie Hernandez. He's executive chef and business partner of Taqueria del Sol, a small chain of restaurants in Tennessee and Georgia. We're talking about his new cookbook. It's called Turnip, Greens, and Tortillas, A Mexican Chef Spices Up the Southern Kitchen. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for Eddie about Mexican cooking, Southern cooking, you name it, or if you have experience with this kind of food, combining Southern and Mexican traditions. Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can find some recipes at WPR.org/FoodFriday. Eddie, you have a recipe you've shared with us for tamales. We've got corn poblano and cheese tamales. Eddie, I love eating tamales. I am scared to make them. It seems to me they're really complicated. Is it as hard as I think it is?
Not the corn with the peppers and the poblanos. That one is not that hard. It's really not that much complicated because it's not that many ingredients. The thing that makes tamale hard is doing the filling. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but when you're doing corn and peppers, it's really easy to chop the stuff, get a really good piece of cheese, and then just making the dough. So it's not really, really that hard, you know. I mean, I'm so blessed because I can get fresh ground corn masa here in Atlanta. I don't know about where you at. But if you can get some, you know, all you got to do is basic spices, cumin, white pepper. You know, some people's afraid to use lard, butter, or oil will do the trick. And then a good stock. You know, you can either get vegetable stock, chicken stock, pork stock. It depends on the filling. That's the kind of stock you want to use. And you can wrap them in, on the corn cobs, but also I've been experimenting with aluminum foil. But I wrap them in, you know, on inside aluminum foil and steam it, and they do the same thing. And you don't have to wait for the corn leaves to be ready to wrap them up and spread all these. So there's a bunch of ways to do this thing. Tamales is a very common part in Memphis, in the Delta near the Mississippi River. They're called hot tamales. And I used to eat them when I used to play in the band. We would play in Taylor, Texas. And every New Year's Eve, we were the band that will always play the state fair there. And I would be looking for these tamales all over the place until I found them. They were different, and that's why I liked them. It's not that they were better than the ones that my mom or, you know, my cousin's mother-in-law made, but they were made with cornmeal. And they had ground beef inside, and they were little, and they were wrapping in six packs, and you know, and I just loved those little devils. And I went to Greenville, Mississippi a couple of years ago, and I really wanted to show the difference of tamales that we have in Mexico by creating one from the north, one from the south, and at the sur tamales, which are big in Mexico. But I think that for the most part, you need not to be afraid. The recipes in the book are very simple. You know, not a lot of ingredients, very simple steps. And you should at least try it one time. But I tell you what's a lot of fun to do at home is you make the dough, and then you go get the kids, and you teach them how to wrap the tamales. And once they get the hang of it, just walk back a little bit, and then go get your beer, sit down, and watch.
That sounds great. Now, the cornmeal you like was Maseca Masa Harina. What is the – we love our cheese in Wisconsin. Eddie, what kind of cheese do you like to use in these tamales?
Gouda would be an excellent one.
Gouda?
Use.
I would never have thought of that.
Gouda. That would be incredible. You know, obviously, there's tons of Mexican cheeses. But what it will help you sell the tamal to your friends is if you put an item that they know. You know, I can say, well, you can get a Sodero cheese or Chihuahua cheese. And a lot of people might don't know what the cheese tastes like or what. So they'll kind of pull back a little bit. But if you say that you're going to put Gouda and fresh corn and poblano peppers in it, I guarantee you everybody's going to get one.
We're talking to Eddie Hernandez. His new cookbook is Turnip Greens and Tortillas. A Mexican chef spices up the Southern kitchen. Eddie, I got to ask about the turnip greens, because that was something that was new to you when you moved to the South, right?
Yes. What a great story, you know. Who would have thought that 30 years later, Turnip Greens will be the title of a book? You know, I never dreamed of that, you know, to be honest with you. You know, when I was first introduced to turnip greens, it was a customer of ours named Bobby Avery who brought me a bag. And I just took them to the bank and they went bad because I didn't know what to do with them.
You had no idea what to do with these turnip greens this guy brought in.
He shows up with another bag the next Friday, and now I'm feeling bad. So I went to Mike, my business partner, and I said, Mike, what are these things? He says, turnip greens. And I said, okay, what do you do with them? And how you eat him? And this is what Mike has been so good to me over the years. He says, okay, we're going to go eat lunch. I'll take you to some places. And we went to a couple of restaurants, meat and three kind of places, and everybody cooked their turnip greens differently. So I, you know, we didn't have, like, all these recipes in the web like we do today. So I tried to understand what people like about those things. And I said, okay, well, this is sort of like the ones we have in Mexico. Let me try this. So I cook them differently, and I might love them. I mean, he said, did you write this recipe? And I said, no. He says, well, no, you need to write it somewhere. You don't want to lose it. And we keep him away at the barn that night, and Bobby loved the greens. Next Friday, he showed up with another bag. But now the customer showed up, and they go like, you got any of those turnip greens? And we know for a little while. Eventually, we comply with them, and we put them on the menu. And that was in 1988. They're still on the menu today.
And now we can get turnip greens here in Wisconsin, and I'll be honest, Eddie, I think I don't always know what to do with them. People don't know what to do with them here. What do you recommend we do with those turnip greens?
Well, in the book, if you look at the book, it's very simple. You need to cook the greens on its own, which is water. Don't put anything on it. You want to take the bitterness of the plant away. And once the plant has been blanched, you know, I mean, it takes about 20 minutes for most people. Drain the water, chop them up, put them aside. Then another pan, you start to make your sauce or the base for the turnip greens, which includes the garlic, the tomatoes, the peppers, and chicken stock. And once you have everything back into the pot, then you put the greens back. Now this is when you really simmer them for 25 minutes. And let me tell you, I eat them all the time. They are really good. I like them.
And then we could serve that with maybe some pork?
Yeah, you can. Well, actually, turnip greens traditionally, a lot of people serve them as a side dish. But when you taste mine and you taste the broth, you want to eat them like a soup. You know, just give me a piece of cornbread and move out of the way. You know, I'm in it. I like to eat them with tortillas, but it's just my own personal preference.
I want to check in one more item you shared with us, a dessert. This is your secret dessert. You don't put it on your menu, natilla. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Well, there's something that my mom used to make for me. And we used to eat it hot, which I still do. You know, every day we make natilla, and I always get a cup of the hot natilla because that's how I like it. But I discovered one day, I had some left, and I didn't want to throw it away, so I put it in the cooler, and it got solid. And my son came in, and he loved it. He called the baby yak. And then he would ask me, and say, Daddy, can you make some more baby yak? So one day I put it on the menu at Sundown Cafe, another restaurant that we had, and it was a big hit. When we opened Taquerias del Sol, the menu was very limited, and we really didn't want to put any of the sauce because it takes too long to do. And we wanted to have a fast casual restaurant, so no dessert were included. However, I always had natillas for the kids. And, you know, I used to give them away. Yeah, so some of the kids, they behaved really well. And the word got out, and now it's like the secret chopper item where everybody goes like, you don't know they have natilla? And they go, no, Hulk, no, you need to be a VIP. they'll give you one.
Eddie, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the interview.
That's Eddie Hernandez, executive chef and business partner at the restaurant chain Taqueria del Sol. His cookbook is called Turnip Greens and Tortillas, A Mexican Chef Spices Up the Southern Kitchen. You can find some of the recipes we've been talking about at WPR.org/Food Friday. Natilla, that secret dessert he was just talking about, the corn, poblano, and cheese tamales, and then that slow-cooked beef, slow cooker barbacoa tacos party platter. And if you have recipes like this that you like to make, you can tell us about that too. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. And again, find those recipes and lots of Food Friday recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. There's a Twitter feud a-brewing about a word, and that word is awesome. Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson got it rolling with this tweet. He wrote, "In my day, the word awesome was reserved for things like curing polio and walking on the moon, not for food or TV shows." Well, that got some people's attention, including the official Merriam-Webster Dictionary. They replied with a one-word scolding, "Neil." Now imagine that said in the collective voice of a dignified but snarky dictionary that's been around for almost 200 years. And former Congressman from Michigan John Dingell replied, "Lighten up, nerd." The official definition of awesome, according to Merriam-Webster, is inspiring awe, or they say informally it can mean terrific or extraordinary. Now, if you, like Neil deGrasse Tyson, don't like the awesome inflation, the use of awesome in very non-awe-inspiring circumstances, I can point you toward public enemy number one, me. I'll say awesome for just about anything. If you hand me coffee that I've given you money in exchange for, I'll probably say that it's awesome, or a donut or something like that. Or you answer my, you know, customer service question or technical question about a computer. That's awesome. I throw it around. And I have to admit, Neil deGrasse Tyson, I am not filled with a deep, inspiring sense of awe in these situations. So blame me here on Central Time.